This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Dole won all 8 of yesterday's Republican primaries. Today, 2 of his rivals, Lamar Alexander and Richard Lugar, dropped out. Even Patrick Buchanan admitted that Dole's nomination seems inevitable, although Buchanan is staying in the race. My guest Michael Kinsley is, among other things, Patrick Buchanan's former sparring partner on the CNN show Crossfire. They were co-hosts for the better part of 6 years. Kinsley is also the former editor of The New Republic. He writes essays for Time magazine and has been published in The New Yorker. Many of his essays from the past 9 years are published in his new book, Big Babies. Kinsley recently left the Beltway for the state of Washington, where he's launching a new online news magazine that will be published by Microsoft. I asked him, now that Dole is the likely Republican nominee, how much power he thinks Buchanan will have to shape the Republican agenda.
I think he'll have less power than people now think. You know, it was in the interest of the media to keep this thing a horse race as long as they possibly could. And that was why Buchanan, one reason at least, why Buchanan got such a ride. And even Lamar Alexander, who never got many votes, was treated very seriously for a long time. The Republicans are now all going to rally around, and I think Pat will himself pipe down a little bit. I could be wrong. So I think he will not have all that much influence, because Dole's going to win it overwhelmingly. He's not going to really need Buchanan. There'll be a little bit of a tussle about how big a role he'll have at the convention. Will he get to give a speech? Will it be live? Will it be prime time and all that sort of thing? And people will say, look what happened when he gave that speech in 1992. And we'll rehash all that stuff, but I don't think he'll have much influence.
What does the primary say to you about the state of the Republican Party?
Well, I am not one of these people who believes that the Republicans are going to tear themselves apart, and I think I've been borne out on this. I'm a Democrat. I'm usually vote Democratic. I'm sympathetic to the Democratic Party, but Democrats are enthusiastic committers of fratricide. They love having internal wars tearing themselves apart. I like to say liberals are always looking for heretics. Conservatives are always looking for converts. And the Republicans are much more businesslike. I admire their efficiency, their ruthlessness. There is no way they were going to let Pat Buchanan tear this party apart, and they didn't.
Do you think that the results of yesterday's primaries are going to turn Super Tuesday into No Big Deal Tuesday?
Yeah, I do think that. I think, in fact, this whole Republican experience may have the solitary result of not only reducing the influence of Super Tuesday, but reducing the influence of New Hampshire. Because I think for the first time since 1964, this could be wrong, the nominee of the Republican Party will not be the guy who won New Hampshire. And I think that would be a healthy thing. Let some other state have its turn.
Does it annoy you that New Hampshire has this big symbolic importance in the primaries?
Well, I've listened now for 4 years to John Sununu telling me how this New Hampshire is the perfect place for this sort of thing to go on. But he failed to persuade me. It does seem to me a little silly that, for example, Pat Buchanan can win by a few hundred votes in one party's primary in a small state like New Hampshire, and suddenly for a month be taken seriously as a presidential candidate. It does seem to me to be sort of an unrealistic system we have there.
Your new book, your new collection is called Big Babies. And in the introduction, you talk about how if there's a theme that runs through these pieces, it's your annoyance at the fatuous populism that dominates American politics. I want you to describe what you mean by that fatuous populism and if you see that playing out in the presidential race.
I guess a brief summary of this fatuous populism, pseudo-populism I would call it, is the politicians are awful, but the people are wonderful. And the problem with this country is that the politicians are alienated from the people and separate from the people and don't give the people what they want. In fact, the political problems we face, the federal debt being the clearest example, are a result of the politicians being exquisitely attuned to the wishes of the people and giving the people exactly what they want. And I'm not here to say that the politicians are so wonderful, but the people aren't so great either. and blaming our problems on the politicians ignoring the wishes of the people gets it exactly wrong. That's the basic point of the Big Babies theme running through this book.
Well, you also say that people demand flagrantly incompatible things, such as...
Yes, they say, how dare you raise my taxes? How dare you cut my middle-class entitlement programs? And dear, oh dear, how dare you run up this national debt?
So they
don't, as I say in this book, they don't want leadership. They want alchemy.
So how do you see this playing out in the presidential race?
Well, it's played out in an interesting way. Over recent years, the main victims of this populist resentment have been the Democrats, because the Republicans have come in and say the Democrats are running up this national debt. The Democrats are mismanaging the government, and there are these easy solutions. And then now the Republicans are controlling Congress, suddenly they're the victims of it, and I almost have to feel a little sorry for them. The people are saying, yes, we want a balanced budget, but we don't want our Medicare touched. And the Democrats have done a little bit of demagoguing on that, as the Republicans did in earlier years. But the Republicans are on the losing side of it. So you could say it's fitting revenge, or you could say it's an unfortunate sign for our country, and I guess it's a little bit of both.
Michael Kinsley is my guest, and his new collection of pieces is called Big Babies. He's the former editor of The New Republic, the former TRB columnist, a former co-host of Crossfire on CNN, and he's now getting ready to launch a new online news magazine. Well, as Patrick Buchanan's former co-host on CNN's Crossfire, do you look at Buchanan and think, my gosh, it might have been me running for president?
No, I have never had the slightest interest in political office, or it seems to me running for office is so awful. Pat really enjoys being on the hustings. People ask me, why is he doing it? And I ask myself, why on earth is he doing it, since he never has a chance? And the one answer to that is he had a bit more of a chance than I gave him credit for, although that was already, we can see now, today, as opposed to a week ago or 2 weeks ago, vastly exaggerated. But the other answer is he really loves being out there on the speaking circuit. He loves the adulation, the crowds. He loves talking, hearing his own voice. And I think a lot of people with political ambition, you have to have a certain love of that. Bill Clinton has a love of being on the campaign trail. Even Bob Dole does. But it seems like an awful life to me, and I think to most sensible people.
It must be really interesting for you to watch him on the campaign trail, since you know him so well.
Well, you know, Terry, I don't really know him well. We worked together for the best part of 6 years. Every afternoon we had this very intense on-the-air experience of arguing with each other. And he was always very affable and friendly most of the time. Sometimes we got into fights that lasted after the cameras went off. But most of the time, you know, he was civil and even friendly. But I don't ever feel I was ever his friend, or we ever connected in any social way, or that, I, for that matter, that I ever really understood him as a person. There's a certain opaqueness there.
Michael, how did you get involved in the TV pundit business?
Well, I was editor of The New Republic for many years in Washington. The New Republic is a very useful institution for the TV producers and TV bookers needing people to come on and argue things, because its staff are people who are well informed about what's going on in Washington, who are allowed to express opinions because it's an opinion magazine and makes no pretense to objectivity. So in the early 80s, mid-80s, I was being invited as a guest on various shows like the McLaughlin Group and Crossfire sometimes, and then I became the summer substitute for Tom Braden, who was, when he went on vacation, who was the previous guy opposite Buchanan. And then Braden wanted to retire, and they needed someone new. They asked me if I wanted to do it, and it was certainly nothing I'd ever thought about very hard, but I thought, what the heck? And so I did it.
You wrote a piece that was printed in The New Yorker in October of 1992 called Mamas, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Pundits. It's a really funny piece, and I'd like you to read an excerpt of it for us.
Sure, I'll be happy to. Just keep in mind that this was tongue-in-cheek. This was from The New Yorker in 1992, during the election that year. You probably think it's easy to be a pundit. From afar, it must look like a pretty soft life, making a living just spouting opinions. Sitting in front of the TV, watching the members of the McLaughlin Group as they rate on a scale of 1 to 10 the likelihood of a thunderstorm in Milwaukee next week, you're tempted to think, any idiot could do that. But it takes a special kind of idiot. not to brag, but I know these people. Favoring friends and family with beautifully wrought opinions about Ross Perot or the North American Free Trade Agreement in the comfort of your own home, you're like the competent amateur cook who thinks it would be neat to run a restaurant. But the professional pundit's life is hell. It's opine, 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 day in and day out, until you never want to have another opinion again. What used to be one of life's great pleasures, perusing the newspapers over morning coffee, becomes a nightmare. At the crack of dawn, even as the professional restaurateur is out selecting fresh vegetables and fish so his customers can later enjoy a leisurely meal, the professional pundit is feverishly assembling the day's haul of fresh opinions. Here's this morning's Times. Senate passes bill to charge makers for drug approval. Oh no, what do I think of that? CIA chief orders investigation of statements in Iraq bank case. That headline contains at least three words, CIA, investigation, and bank, that together carry the powerful subliminal message, do not read this article. Life is too short. But for the pundit, there is no escape. New use is found for abortion pill. Maoist chief of Peru is sentenced to life. That sounds like a good thing, but is there a catch? We're still on the Times front page, and we haven't even gotten to the 18 stories dissecting the presidential debates. TV punditry adds a whole extra layer of terror, mainly of being exposed as an ignoramus. It's 10 seconds to showtime, and you suddenly realize you have no idea where Somalia is. You're on the air, opinions are flying like shrapnel, and you're about to demand that Nicholas Brady be fired as Secretary of the Treasury when a small voice in your head whispers, "Are you absolutely sure he's not the Secretary of Commerce?" The words freeze in your throat. You gurgle. You decide to play it safe and demand that Richard Darman be fired as head of the Office of Management and Budget. Wait! Or is it the Council of Economic Advisors? Too late.
I love that. Very funny.
Thank you.
Did you ever do anything like that on the air? Actually, you know, get a person's name wrong or confuse their office with somebody else's?
Oh, yeah. I often would blank out on someone's name. You probably do it too, or maybe you don't, Terry, but they give you a little card to remind you who these people are. And when you have to thank them at the end, it's always a test. Do you have to look down at the card, or can you remember who this congressman is and that congresswoman?
Do you hide the card so that nobody sees?
Well, they used to make us put everything on blue cards for some reason. I think they're supposed to show up less on TV or something like that.
Now, are you relieved that you're not on TV every day having to have opinions about everything?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I miss the people back at CNN, but I don't miss doing the show at all. I enjoyed it for the 6 years I did it, but I'd really had about enough.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I probably am. But I felt at the beginning of our interview when I was asking you about your take on the primaries, a certain resistance as if you were saying, do I have to have an opinion on everything?
Well, I think you aren't wrong. It is one of the luxuries, as I suggest in this piece, which you had me read a bit from, that it's more work than it seems generating opinions on all this stuff, and you want them to be intelligent. You hope they can be correct most of the time when they're predictive, but it's a great luxury not to have to do it. And you really do read the paper with much more pleasure when you realize you don't have to reach a conclusion about everything. And certain articles, if they don't interest you, you don't even have to read them.
Michael Kinsley is my guest, and he has a new collection of pieces called Big Babies. And he's a former editor of The New Republic, former TRB columnist there. He writes a lot for Time magazine, written for The New Yorker, and is starting a new online news magazine. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Kinsley, and he has a new collection of pieces called Big Babies. Now, you're changing your line of business a little bit. You're editing a new online news magazine that will be published online by Microsoft. This is a real departure for you. I mean, you've always been in the news magazine business, but it's been in print that you've... I mean, it's been... paper that you've written for. What leads you in this online direction now? What do you think you can do there that you couldn't do in paper publishing?
Well, being a magazine editor is what I really love to do. And this, as I was saying before, this Crossfire thing which came along was a bit of a detour for me, and I enjoyed it, but I really wanted to get back into magazine editing. And one advantage of an online magazine is that people will back me to do it, because it's new and because people are searching for for ways to fulfill the promise of the technology. But the technology has three different sorts of advantages over print. It has many disadvantages compared to print. It's new. People don't have computers. People don't like to read things on computers. All these are challenges we face, but it does have several advantages. Number one, there's a huge economic advantage in that you don't have to print. You don't have to pay postage. You don't have to pay for paper, which is very expensive. You don't have to tear down trees, for that matter, for it. And we're going to pass that economic advantage on to our readers. This will be a lot cheaper than a Time or a Newsweek or a New Yorker or the New Republic or one of those magazines. Number two, delivery is instantaneous. You know, living out here in Washington State, I realize I was sort of spoiled in Washington, D.C. I got all my media very quickly. You know, I even got hand-delivered copies of Time and Newsweek and the New Yorker. Hot off the press, is only a day or two old, whereas as a regular subscriber out in the West, I get it 5 or 6 days down the road. Well, in an online magazine, you don't have to be a VIP to get it instantaneously. And the other advantage of online magazines is the one that gets most of the attention, but in a way interests me least, which is the multimedia, the interactivity you can have back and forth with your readers. You can have the reader can click around and do different things, and you can have movie reviews with clips of the movie in it and that sort of thing. And well, we're going to have quite a bit of that, but I think a lot of that can be quite gimmicky, too.
Yes, I was wondering if you felt you were getting pushed into a gimmicky direction, because there's so much pressure now, and everybody's doing stuff online to be unique to what can be done online and can't possibly be done in print.
We're trying to have a rule at this publication that we are only going to do these technological whiz-bang things if they really have journalistic value, if they really enhance the journalism, and we're not going to do them for their own sake. Now, I will say this. Being out at Microsoft and being surrounded by technological geniuses and seeing all the stuff they can do, it's very hard to resist the temptation to say, well, let's do this, let's do that, because it is sort of cool, as they like to say. And so I'm sure I've weakened my principles to some extent in the past couple of months as I've been getting into this. But we're going to try and hold fast to the rule that it's the journalism, stupid, to paraphrase James Carville.
Well, we'll hold you accountable.
Thanks.
Now, are you going to try to make money through advertising?
Making money is an aspiration. We hope to at least break even and possibly make money through advertising. We're also, it's not going to be free, though, to subscribers. It will cost something, but it will cost a lot less than a traditional magazine.
Oh, so it will be subscriber. You know, I'm thinking that a lot of publications are maybe rethinking how and where advertising is placed in online publications as opposed to paper publications.
Well, that's one of 20 or 30 dozen fascinating questions that I spend my day thinking about instead of thinking about who's going to win the next primary. It's one of the reasons I enjoy doing that. This is a brand new field, and where you put the advertising, what the relationship with the advertiser is. One of the things that bothers me about a lot of stuff online is that the firewall between the advertising and the editorial content is a lot fuzzier than it is in traditional print journalism.
Well, why is it fuzzier online?
I think it's partly because people are just still floundering to create the rules, and partly because a lot of journalists are not involved in it yet. It tends to be more the business side of things. And a lot of the websites are actually run by the sponsors. It's sort of like the early days of television when you had Texaco Star Theater, and it was the companies that were the sponsors that were essentially producing the TV shows. And there's a lot of that sort of thing online, although many of the sites are not like that.
Your publication, your online publication, isn't being published just yet. What's your start date?
Our start date is we're looking at toward the end of May.
Do you wish that you were publishing now during the big primary race, or are you just as glad to not have to cover the day-by-day politics of it?
It doesn't bother me to miss that for precisely the reason you say. This publication, first of all, it's not going to be partisan. It's not going to be a liberal publication. It's not going to be a conservative publication for that matter. It's going to be whatever it turns out to be. We're going to try and have sharp writers and sharp analysts commenting and analyzing events. But it's also going to be more about policy than politics. And if we were up a month ago, we would have been talking about whether the flat tax is a good idea or not, much more than whether it benefits one candidate over the other.
Okay, well, Michael Kinsley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Kinsley's new collection of essays is called Big Babies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.